Good morning, everybody. So, it's Mother's Day. Anybody going, It's Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all of you who are mothers, and happy Mother's Day to all of you who were born of people who are mothers or were mothers. I brought this statue up for Mother's Day, put her on the altar. This is Pajapati. She was Buddha's aunt and stepmother. His mother died when she was an infant, and so she raised him after Maya died. And she was also Ananda's mother, you know, Ananda, who was Buddha's attendant. So she's got her hands up in a mudra, two mudras actually. The first one on her right side, it's the greeting, right? Her hand is up like she's saying hi. That's called the fear not mudra. And the left hand is down on her side. The palm is facing outward and open, and the fingers are pointing down, and that's the gift-bestowing gesture of compassion mudra. So the fear not mudra is a mudra of protection and reassurance. It's a cultural universal, I think, from ancient times. You know, this was the greeting that you would give when you met somebody, and it was because, originally, it's to show that you don't have a weapon, right? So it's reassurance. And the gift bestowing gesture of compassion mudra, it's also called the welcome mudra sometimes. And it's about offering and compassion and sincerity. So it's often associated with offering the teachings. So that's what she's doing. She lives on the altar downstairs in the women's changing room, but I thought I'd bring her up today since it's Mother's Day. Her name was Pajapati, but later she became the leader of the women followers of Buddha, and so they called her Maha Pajapati. Maha means great. So this is great Pajapati here up on the altar. And being the leader of the first women followers of Buddha, that leads into the topic that I want to talk about today, which is becoming a Buddhist. It's becoming a Buddhist. Because I am just fascinated by the idea that, you know, here we are as a Sangha, and we come together and we do this practice, and I think it's pretty safe to say that none or very few of us were raised as Buddhists. And that's because Buddhism has only been widespread in this country for about 50 years or so, about a half a century. So when I go around I used to go around and give talks sometimes to high school groups, and I liked, especially when it was a public high school, I like to start off by asking a few questions. And I want to do that today partly because it will help and partly because I've always wanted to ask these questions from up here. So if you don't mind doing a show of hands, please do. So how many of us were raised without any religious affiliation at all? Anybody? A few. A few more than I would have expected. Huh. How many were raised in households that were sort of nominally religious, but not in a way that really kind of showed up in daily life? We used to call these Sunday, More hands going up all the time. So more than the non-religious, but and how many were raised in a devoutly religious household? Okay, so a few more, and then a lot more. Was anybody here raised Buddhist? A little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That was more than I expected. They were hippies. There you go. There you go. So while I'm at it, asking questions. So how many people have been coming here or some other Buddhist center for 10 or more years? Anybody? Okay. 2 or more years? A lot for 2 or more years. Or less than 2 or just visiting today? Okay. Some of those too. Alrighty. So we come from all kinds of different backgrounds, all kinds of religious backgrounds, non-religious backgrounds. And, you know, it's really interesting to give a talk when you know that that's the case in the room. When I was a kid, you know, on Sunday, when they gave the sermon, if it was about, you know, the prodigal son or grace or original sin, the person speaking could be pretty sure that everybody knew exactly what they were talking about. And not only that, they knew the stories, but also it was sort of in their bones. It was in their bones. But here we don't have that kind of common understanding or commonality of early experience that we would have if we had all been raised in the same religion since birth. You know, and there isn't even an agreement on whether Buddhism is a religion. You know, is it a religion or is it a philosophy? Well, for the purposes of the talk today, I'm going to treat it as if it were a religion. When the high school classes ask, it's always the kids at the parochial high schools who ask this question, is it a religion or is it a philosophy? And I always think they've been prepped by their teachers when they ask that. And I always tell them, you know, it's both, and I could argue either side of that one. But anyway, so for today, I'm going to talk about it as if it's a religion. So here we are, and if we're showing up and intending to live our lives in accordance with the Buddha Dharma, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean? And how do we go about getting it into our marrow? How do we do that if we start as adults? I was 40 when I started this practice, and having come from a tradition where it was really deeply, deeply part of the family life and who I was, that was something that concerned me a lot. Let me start by sort of parsing out a definition of what a Buddhist is. I'd say it's a person who has looked into the Buddhist teachings some and has some level of confidence in the teachings, and does her best to align her actions and her intentions with the Buddha Dharma, with the teachings of Buddha, particularly the Eightfold Path. Somebody who's kind of made that connection and has stated that inner intention, at least to herself. So that's what I would say being a Buddhist is. And what it's not is an identity or an affiliation. So there's no ledger to sign, you know, there's no test to take. We should have a test at the end of this. That would be cool. And not a true false either. Well, yeah, true false test in Zen, wouldn't that be great? My next talk. So anyway, there's no test to talk. It's more of a way of responding to the world and responding to the circumstances that present themselves in every moment. So from a Buddhist point of view, actually, you can be a a Presbyterian or a Hindu or Amish, and also consider yourself to be a Buddhist. That doesn't go both ways a lot. I think a lot of leaders of other religions would not like their parishioners to describe themselves as, say, evangelical Protestant Buddhists. Or, you know, well, whatever. But it's not a problem from the Buddhist perspective. And I think part of the reason for that is that we don't convert to Buddhism. I started off thinking about this talk as being about conversion, but that isn't something that we really do. We don't convert, particularly not to Zen, at least. It's more a way of aligning yourself with the teachings and aligning your responses to what comes up in every Dharma gate and every moment with the teachings. Sometimes when you have been here for a while, you discover, I think, a deeper appreciation from whatever religion or non-religion you were raised with, you know. You're here for a while and you might start noticing all of the ways that you respond in ways that reflect the way you were raised as a kid. I'll give you this is a really mundane example. When I first started, I was at a different Dharma center, and during retreats, we would go in to see the teacher in order of where you were in the room. So I knew that I was up next to go in, but when the bell rang, we were right in the middle of the morning service, and we were chanting, sort of with a bowed position where your head was touching the floor. And so the bell rang, and I went, well, what do? Do I get up and run in there, or do I wait for the chant to end? And so my Catholic upbringing told me, wait for the chant to end. So I went in, and when I got in there, I asked the teacher if that was the way that a Zen student would respond, and he said no, a Zen student would just get up no matter what and go in. So it's, you know, it's little things like that, but then it's also bigger things too, like, you know, I think about things like grace and, you know, the soul and things like that that are just so deeply embedded in our marrow when we're kids, that you sort of ask yourself, what do you do with that when you've been hanging around a Buddhist center as long as I have? So you get here, and you know, maybe you have some affinity and you stick around, and then at some point, if you're like me, you notice one day that there's this huge learning curve, because you know, Buddhism is a very simple religion. It's almost embarrassingly simple. When I used to go to high schools, and I would tell them, well, you know, the Four Noble Truths, and they would go, and that's it? I mean, I could see that on their face. I was imagining them saying that. I go, yeah, that's pretty much it. But on the other hand, there are libraries full of texts, wonderful texts and sutras, and stories, and it occurred to me, I will never know enough of those stories. Somebody asked me a question last week that they thought was a pretty simple question that they just didn't know, and I had no idea. And so they said, that's okay, I'll go ask Tim. And they asked Tim, and they came back and told me what he had said. And I was like, he totally made that up. I don't know if he did or not. It sounded good. So anyway, so, you know, at some point I was kind of overwhelmed by all the things that I didn't know, and knew that I would never know enough, never know enough. It was really kind of daunting. Am I the only one? There are other people who felt, thank you, me and Andrea. We're like this. Thank you. It's good not to be alone. So I have three ways I want to tell you about that you can immerse yourself in this practice. This is Rosemary's List. In Buddhism, we like lists a lot. And they're lists by great teachers from ancient times. Well, this isn't one of them. This is one that I made up this week. So the first way, and everybody knows what this one's going to be, the first way is to establish a regular sitting practice. And if you really want to go deeper and study your mind, I think you really also need to do retreats. We have a lot of opportunities for retreats here. We have some sort of retreat every month, and sometimes more than once a month. And they go all the way from a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon to we go down to Hokkyoji. We do a retreat in southeastern Minnesota out in the country. And our longest one is a week-long one. It's the Big Kahuna. It's Rahatsu. It's the beginning of December when we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment. We're here for a whole week. But, you know, you can also just put your toe in the water and just come for a couple hours on a Saturday afternoon and get an idea of it. But the important thing is that regular sitting practice, just doing it every day, every day, every day, every day, or at least pretty regularly. And then going along with that, I would say, is investigating what this time that you spend on the cushion has to do with the rest of your life. An easy way, if you come here during the week for sitting meditation, in between the two sits, we do walking meditation. And if all you've ever done is sitting meditation, you get up and you walk, and you're doing the same thing, you're doing meditation, but it's standing up and moving, so you've added another element to it. And another thing is work practice. There you are really paying attention to what you're doing in a way that maybe we don't when we're you know, mopping the floor at home always. Some places they call it work meditation. I like that. Some places they call it work yoga. And I like that a lot because then they call you a yogi. And that makes me feel like I don't know what. Anyway. So work practice is another one. My first teacher used to say all the time in this very kind of zen-y voice, he would say, your life is exactly zazen. And he would say it in a way that would make me think that Katagiri must have said that. And I would think, you know, oh, you're just being such a Zen guy. And I kind of blew him off because that's the kind of Zen student I was. But he said that all the time. Your life is exactly zazen, and zazen is exactly your life. And, you know, I didn't pay much attention to it until one day when I was serving a meal at Sesshin at a formal retreat. And I was, you know, carrying a pot of soup or something around the zendo. And suddenly, it became exactly zazen. It was just the same as zazen. I kind of dropped into that place that you can go to in zazen sometimes, or where you can return to, I guess is a better way. And I went, I get this. And it's something that I don't really have words for. You just have to do enough zazen and maybe enough retreat practice to see it sometime. So the main thing that I teach these days is sewing Buddha's robe. That's these small versions of Buddha's robe that are called Rakusu, and also the larger versions that you see priests wearing here during the week when we have services in the morning. And I just told the current class, we have a class that started last Monday, and I just told them that the goal of the class when I teach it is to, at the end of the class, have a raksu that, you know, is a rectangle and will hang around your neck and looks like it's supposed to. That's the goal of the class, but actually my mission for the class is to get people to see that, to see the connection between what's happening when you're on the cushion and the rest of your life. So when we're sewing these things, we aren't talking, and it's a meditation. So with every stitch we take, we say to ourselves, taking refuge in Buddha. And we're just paying attention to what's happening right now. And at some point our mind will wander off and maybe we'll make a mistake and have to tear out the last 20 minutes of stitching. But when that happens, we don't make it worse. We just do it and go back and come back and back and back. And at the end of the class, I want everybody to be done with their raksus, but I'm a really happy girl if they get that. So, sitting meditation and making the connection between that and the rest of your life, that's one way you can immerse yourself. And the second way you can immerse yourself in this practice is by getting familiar with the teachings. And the way that I did that was by listening to years and years of Dharma talks and also taking classes. We have a lot of different people. We have a lot of priests here. So you get to hear Dharma talks from people with really different interests and perspectives. And I think that's really great. There's also lots and lots of talks online that you can listen to if you like. And there are also lots and lots and lots of books you can read. My caveat with that, though, is don't let reading become a substitute for doing the practice, right? Actually doing it. You know, there's reading a book about water skiing, and then there's actually getting in the water and water skiing. And it's the same thing with Zen practice. When I first started doing this, before I joined a Sangha, I read a whole bunch of books, and what I wanted to know was, what does it mean to become enlightened? I was really interested in that. And the books would sort of try to talk about that, and then they would all say, but really, you need to join a Sangha and you need to sit. And I'd be like, yeah, I'll get to that, but first tell me what it means to be enlightened, right? Because I'm a slow learner. So go ahead and read if you like, but don't confuse that with what's going to happen if you sit on the, if you actually do the practice. So the third way to immerse yourself is to find particular teachings that really speak to you and sort of immerse yourself in those. Look deeply into them. Pick one that you really, really like and live with it for, you know, a year or two or three or a lifetime, a couple lifetimes. Heart Sutra is good. We have a lot of sort of one or two page sutras that are good for that. Heart Sutra, Metta Sutra, Harmony of Difference and Sameness, Fukan Zazengi, the Universal Recommendations for Zazen, Song of the Grassroots Hermitage. They're all in the chant books. So find one that you really love and memorize it, you know, recite it at home every day before you sit. A good way to memorize it, by the way, what I did when I wanted to memorize these was I would record them and then play the recording when I was in the car. I used to commute back and forth to work. So I would play them in the car and I would record like the first line and then a big pause so that I could insert the second line, and then the second line for when I couldn't remember the second line, and then I'd have another pause. So anyway, maybe you really like the, you know, it doesn't have to be a sutra. Maybe you really like the Brahmaviharas, or maybe you like koans, or really like loving kindness practice or something, but find something that really speaks to you and dive in deeply to it. A couple of years ago, I went to a week-long retreat at St. Paul's Monastery. It's a Benedictine monastery in Maplewood. And Maplewood, I'm pointing like that's the way to Maplewood. Maplewood, Minnesota. And it was a Lectio Divina retreat, so it's a retreat about sacred reading. And so we were all supposed to bring a reading from a sacred text that we wanted to really dive into. And so everybody else in the group, of course, brought something from the Bible, but they know me there and it's okay, so I knew it would be okay, and I took the Heart Sutra along. And so we spent the week, we would read our texts to ourselves, and then we would meditate with them, and we would sort of keep them with us during the week. We'd journal about them, we'd kind of keep them at the sort of at the edge of our consciousness for the whole week. And for those of you who have taken Sitting with Sutras here, this might sound familiar. That's where it came from. I totally swiped it from the Benedictine nuns. And it's a wonderful way to get to know a sutra, and it's also a wonderful way to fall in love with the sutra, just to do that. And another thing I really like to do is use a number of different translations when I'm looking at a sutra. One thing I'll do is I will take the sutra and put a couple of translations side by side like this. I'll put them in it. This is like if you're really a nerd. Andrea. And sometimes I'll put, you know, I'll have like five different translations across the page. And it makes a big difference because they're really different. They can be really different. And one example from that of that is on the front of your bulletin today, I put my favorite Buddhist verse. I love this one. I've loved it for a long, long time. It's chapter 1, verse 5 of the Dhammapada, which is the a collection of the early sayings of Buddhas. And the English translation, this is a very common one. Hatred does not cease by hatred, but by love alone is cured. This is an eternal law. And that is a very poetic translation, and almost all the translations I've seen of it are very similar, but it's not a literal translation. And it should have occurred to me a long time ago that it wasn't a totally faithful translation of what Buddha said, because Buddha didn't really talk about love, hardly at all. I asked Busho this morning if he could think of any time when the Buddha talked about love, and he said, yeah, you know, hatred does not cease by hatred, but by love alone is cured. And it turns out the word that he used wasn't love at all. But I thought about this verse a lot in the aftermath of 9/11 in 2001. Do you remember that the first days in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, everybody was walking around with their hearts kind of blown open, and everybody was so sort of tender and kind, and it was this sort of amazing time. You know, I remember people just being very appreciative of each other, and the whole world was in great sympathy with us because this terrible thing had happened. And then our elected leaders decided that they were going to retaliate and go to war. And I remember thinking, no, bad idea. Hatred does not cease by hatred. And sure enough, next thing you know, the hatred just ramped right up. And before you know it, everything went to hell. And I found myself wondering if expecting the people who were in leadership at that time, I was wondering if it was just too much to expect or for them to love their enemies. You know, I thought, well, maybe that's just unrealistic or impossible. And I remember also thinking, you know, feeling sort of very loftily. Now, if those people had only read this verse, if they were only Buddhists and they know like I do that the only cure for hatred is love, that everything would have been different. And then finally, last fall, I saw an online discussion among a number of Buddhist teachers about this verse, and they were talking about how the translation is, the usual translation that we see is incorrect, and the antidote that was proposed originally wasn't love at all. So the word for hatred in there, in the first line, the word varana is Pali for hatred, and in the third line, there's a word avarana, and that means the opposite of hatred, or the opposite of hatred. So in Pali, and this is the same in Sanskrit and also in English, if you put an A in front of a word, it means the opposite of that. So in English, an atheist is someone who's not an atheist. If you're apolitical, that means that you're not political. If you have an avocation, that means that this is not your vocation, but it's something that you do because you like to do it. So the text should read, hatred does not cease by hatred, but by non-hatred alone is cured. And you can see why they use the word love, because that's kind of clunky. It's not very poetic. But non-hatred is a much broader word than love. And it can include, you know, forgiveness or reconciliation, mindfulness, patience, kindness, understanding, empathy, compassion, resolve, respect. There are a lot of places you can go with non-hatred. And one of the teachers pointed out that we might find it easier to let go of hate if it arises than to aim for a kind of artificial loving kindness, or to aim for kind of a goody two-shoes, I'm going to be a good Buddhist here kind of love. So, you know, if after 9/11 we had gone for what else can we do, what other response can we make that would be non-hatred, things might have turned out different. So, and not hating somebody is really different from loving them. You know, we can be civil and we can be kind to people that we don't have any kind of common ground with. And I think it's way more helpful than trying to force ourselves to love them if we're just not really feeling it, which was a big relief to me. Although when I say that, when I say that verse to myself, I still put love in it, but I put a little asterisk in my mind. I'm saying love, but what I really mean is non-hate. So 9/11 is kind of a big picture example, but I had a more small picture example too. Years ago, I had a friend when I was in college who, when we got out of school, her first job after college was in a big corporation. And it turned out when she got there that one of the people that she had to work with daily, you know, like all the time, who was not her manager but a little bit higher than she was in the hierarchy, was somebody that she didn't get along with at all. Neither one of them liked each other. They just rubbed each other kind of the wrong way. And but they had to work together. And so course, I just heard her side of it, but what it sounded like to me was that both of them would just kind of started needling each other, or, you know, things just went from bad to worse. And they started off kind of not having an affinity for each other, and then pretty after a few months, they just really, really had a problem with each other. And so my friend started out, she would complain about this other person, you know, and stuff. And then she would sort of admit, you know, well, yeah, I may have a part in it. But after, you know, a number of months of that, she just got really tired of it. And it hurt her heart. You know, she didn't like it. She was really wishing this other person would, you know, quit or change or something, but she could see that wasn't going to happen. And then when New Year's rolled around, she told me, I'm going to make a New Year's resolution. And her New Year's resolution was, I'm going to make her like me. And I thought, oh boy, let's see how this goes. Right? But she had a plan. And her plan was that she was just going to be non-reactive. That wasn't a word in the 70s, but that's what I would call it now. She was just going to be non-reactive. She was going to be civil. She was going to be, you know, if she could get to pleasant, that would be great. You know, but this, so this was her plan. And she did it, and she stuck with it for, you know, 2 or 3 months. And she said, you know, I know I'm never going to like her, but I just want her to like me and stay off my back. And the implication being that I can still needle her, right? But anyway, so she did it, and she was just non-reactive, and after a few months, it turned out, much to her astonishment, that that they did start getting along, and they even kind of liked each other. They could go to lunch, you know, she was astonished, and I was astonished on her behalf. And that was way before I had ever heard about that verse. But anyway. So the next time anything like that happens to me, I'm going to do it, and it's going to work, man. But my point with that is that Buddhism is about looking deeply. It's about looking deeply. It's about paying attention. And I think immersing yourself in one teaching, immersing yourself in one sutra, is a really wonderful way to work with these teachings. I think I'm going to end there. I really like hearing stories about how other people came to this practice, or miracle stories like making someone like you and having it turn out okay. See, that's my old Catholic upbringing. I like miracle stories.
Does anybody have anything they want to say, or any questions, or anything? Yes.
I was wondering if you thought the word peace would be a good replacement word, because peace is somewhat, it's across a lot of lines. It also has more to do with, like, your friend, her reaction, and internal. You could almost kind of, I mean, it could go a lot of different ways, more neutral.
Yeah.
Like, peace with Switzerland was always a neutral kind of country, or, you know, with me, myself, and my, I've got a situation with, like, just like with that box. It's like, if I could just say I'm going to be peaceful, that means more neutral.
I think that's a wonderful one. Peaceful. Yeah. Give it a go. Yeah, good luck. Yeah, I think peaceful is wonderful because it comes from within, right? And you can be peaceful with whatever's going around, with whatever is happening.
It's not requiring you to actually love something.
That's right. Yeah. Peace is great. I like that. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah. Andrew.
Yeah, well, when I heard what I was thinking about the opposite of hatred, sorry if I'm deafening people in this room, what I was thinking about is like equanimity.
Equanimity.
Or sort of listening. Because to me, love and hate are often, I mean, they're the flip side of one coin, mm-hmm. very strong emotion, very strong attachment, is just positive or negative. And so I was trying to think of what's the opposite, where those flames are coming up and there's just a calm coolness.
Yeah. Yeah, equanimity is another great one. Yeah, those are both middle way. And there was a great person one time, can't remember his name, who used to talk about the middle way. Jeffrey.
When I was 7 years old, I was playing in a sandbox with my brother Gene and Billy McAllister, who lived down the block. And we had water, and we were making roads and buildings and had cars. And we were driving around in a sandbox. And all of a sudden, I dropped into this space where everything was just perfect. And it was so stunning that after a few minutes, I asked my brother and Billy, do you have this sense that we've been here before and you knew exactly what was going to happen? And they said, no. So many years later, when I connected with Buddhism, I started doing daily meditation and sesshins, this remembrance kind of floated up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my practice moves me into a kind of a similar space, but not with the depth that that one had, somehow or another. So when people ask me if I'm a Buddhist, there's this embarrassed pause.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And I guess the embarrassed pause is partly because of that prior experience, but also because the teachers of our teachers were supporters of Japanese imperialism mm-hmm. down the line. And there are numerous examples of people who are Buddhists who are not exemplifying the sort of skillful practice that the world needs.
Mm-hmm. So. When I was a kid, it completely rocked me to find out that Hitler was Catholic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember. Yeah. It's sort of the opposite of your experience in the thing. You find that out. But yeah, those early experiences, like Buddha under the rose apple tree, mm-hmm. right? You know, he was about that age, sitting under the rose apple tree during what, plowing or something,
yeah.
and all of a sudden this peace which path us all path, how's that go? Peace which passeth all understanding. Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to add that one of the things I appreciate about your talks is you seem to have this guiding intention to make it more user-friendly, you know, and I think your point about it's the simplest pieces of it that are the hardest, the most and complex to unpack, and for me it's that the difference between noticing and observing with curiosity and not judgment, and it's like the depths of being able to really do that inside and out honestly and not sort of saying, well, cheat a little bit, I really don't like that, but you
right.
know, but I think it's this sense of, I would never call myself a Buddhist because I'm always in a state of becoming. Is there a point where you yeah. cross the line and there's a critical mass and you call yourself a Buddhist?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, Tim last week talked about ists and isms
yeah.
and how they kind of box us in. You know, well, for me, I was all I wanted was a group to sit with. I wasn't, you know. But I ended up finding this group that it was a small sitting group that met in the basement of a Unitarian church before their Sunday started, and it was Soto Zen. Anyway, and I ended up with this group, so I would go there in the morning, drove across town, go there in the morning early on Sundays, and there were two half-hour sits or something. And then a Dharma talk, and I didn't really care about the Dharma talk, but it was seemed kind of rude to leave after before the Dharma talk started. So I would stay for that, you know.
So your politeness drew you in.
It was my politeness, yeah, yeah, that Midwestern sort of thing. And then I would get in the car and drive back across town, pick up my kids, and go to church. And after about a year, the talks had just really sunk in. And one day, I actually had one of those moments, because I was at my church. I was walking out of the ladies' room, and the minister was walking in, and we were facing each other. We just kind of stopped, and I had this look on my face, and she said, "What is it?" And I said, "I think I'm gone." And I quit going to my lovely Unitarian church in St. Paul, and that was. So, yeah, but you know, I think mostly it's Dharma rain. You know, you walk in the mist, and that kind of rain where it's not really raining, you're walking in the mist and walking in the mist, and then you turn around and notice that you're soaked. Yeah, I think.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I wanted to comment on what you said about 9/11, because I do too remember that moment, and the feeling that I had with how as a country, you know, our leaders could really turn this around if they responded from a place of peace or love, compassion, understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And how I knew that wasn't going to happen. I mean, it seemed to me like a human instinctual, the ego, you know, move to like, well, no, we can't. We have to, you know, show our power and strength instead. Mm-hmm. When I had this image of like, what if we just airdropped food and airdropped, loving things instead of, you know, bombs and other things, because that would show that we really understood that we had hurt some people, you know, that we had done wrong, and we were going to admit to that, you know, and people were suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been sitting for different in Tibetan Buddhism about that time in my life, and also the hatred does not cease by hatred, but by peace or compassion or whatever came into my life at the same time, where I was having conflict with my ex-husband, and I came across this book called The High Conflict Couple, which said that they had this practice, if you could look at your loved one while they were sleeping, right?
Ooh.
And remember why you love them so much. Because during the day, in my mind was blah, 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 blah. You know, just a lot of negativity that kept me in this negative loop with this person,
yeah,
right, who I loved very much and cared for very much, but couldn't get beyond that during the day. But the shift of watching this person sleep and remembering why I loved him shifted me, and through my sitting, shifted me into a place where during the day I was able to change that loop. You know, and it both of those seem to respond to this quote. Thank you.
That's wonderful. I like that. If you're having trouble with someone, imagining them asleep,
mm-hmm,
as a child, especially.
Right. And as a mom,
yeah.
So that was one of the wonderful moments to watch your child sleep.
Yeah.
They could do no wrong.
Yep. Yeah. I like to think of them as if I was their grandmother. You know? So. Anybody else? Anything? Yeah.
I also appreciate your Dharma rain analogy, metaphor, because there was one word I was sort of curious about when you wanted to challenge in your talk is when you said no, after September 11th, this general idea of that through sitting and learning about the teachings, is that enough to say you know something? I feel like that's an important word, and part of crossing over to saying you're a Buddhist, or saying that you know love is the answer to something, or non-hatred. And that's, so I think for our leaders to choose that path is a big leap of faith if they don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's it.
Yeah. You know how this goes. The older I get, the less I know. For sure. The less I know for sure.
But whatever it is in your life, if you reach a saturation point, then that does seem like a personal knowing.
Yeah.
You asked how different people came to Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I asked myself that a few years ago. I said, how did I ever, come from a very religious Catholic background? Didn't even know anything about Buddhism. It occurred to me that, anybody remember the TV show Kung Fu? It's a very violent show, too, now that I've gone back and read it, because he's always getting into a fight. But he had a lot of flashbacks to his time in a monastery, and I assume it was a Buddhist monastery, but those teachings always really resonated with me, even as a child, reading and watching those. And I would watch those shows more for the experience of listening to some wisdom through his remembrance of his teachings in the monastery.
Huh, that's really cool. And don't you find that, I mean, there are a lot of resonances between Catholicism and Buddhism, particularly in the meditative traditions. Mm-hmm. When I talk to Catholic high schoolers, they have all meditated and they're good at it and they know it. They get it.
And the Jesuit tradition.
Yeah, the Jesuit tradition. Yeah. Well, that brings up something else. It's be careful what you let into your mind. You know, whenever I go to a movie that shows previews for like really violent or really scary or, I want to jump up and go up in front of the screen and say, think about what you're letting into your mind here, into your mind stream. And one of these days I'm gonna be kind of an old, goofy enough lady that I'm going to do it. But it works the other way around, too, You're a little kid. Mm-hmm. This is what, you're letting that, it's Dharma brain. Right? Yeah.